Hello, and welcome to Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. I'm Gina Briner, Editor-in-Chief at Live Science.
And I'm Mindy Weisberger, a Senior Writer at Live Science.
Today, we're bringing you a special episode of Life's Little Mysteries. Usually, we keep things pretty light, but this time, we're going to focus on a serious topic that everybody is talking about, and that's the SARS coronavirus 2, the virus that causes the disease COVID-19.
At Life Science, our reporters and our editors are tracking the latest coronavirus developments around the world, from global case numbers and quarantines to vaccine development to best practices for safety, prevention, and treatment.
Here with the latest coronavirus news is Life Science health reporter Nicoletta Lanice. She's at the forefront of our coronavirus coverage.
This episode was recorded on March 12th and features Nicoletta's weekly coronavirus video update and Q&A. New updates are live streamed on Facebook every Thursday at 12 p.m. ET.
Hi, we're here at Live Science bringing you your weekly novel coronavirus update. And again, if you haven't been here before, my name is Nicoletta Lanice and I'm a health reporter here at Live Science. Just to give you a general update on the numbers, and again, before I tell you any case counts, I want to clarify that the numbers I'm about to tell you are confirmed cases, meaning the people have been formally diagnosed with the virus. And that is different from the actual number of cases circulating, because we do not know the actual number of cases. Confirmed cases are based on having had a diagnostic test already. So, that said, the total cases worldwide are now up to 127,863 worldwide. Nearly 81,000 of those are in China. Around the world, there are now over 4,500 deaths, so we're up to 4,718 deaths. And let me just highlight the number of recovered cases as well. I am relying on the Johns Hopkins dashboard that has been tracking cases around the world. As of this morning, the number of recovered was over 68,000 people, compared to nearly 130,000 confirmed cases. Nearly 70,000 people have recovered from the virus as of now. Within the U.S., we are seeing over 1,300 cases at the moment. As of this morning, the death count was up to 38 nationwide. That would be 30 cases in Washington, 4 in California, 2 in Florida, 1 in New Jersey, and 1 in South Dakota. So again, as we're seeing diagnostic testing become more widespread, albeit slowly throughout the U.S., we're going to see the case count rise, and it's inevitable that we will see more deaths from this virus going forward. So we have a lot of quick updates this week, and then I want to open the floor to your questions. So if you have questions throughout this live stream, please enter them in the comments below, and we'll try to get to you. So you probably heard that this week, the World Health Organization finally declared this outbreak a pandemic, meaning it is spreading around the globe. They declared this after the virus had already spread to more than 100 countries worldwide and led to tens of thousands of cases over the course of a couple months. So according to backtracking the virus, it's thought that it actually emerged late November or really early December, so around December 1st. And then we kind of caught wind of it as a global society closer to mid to late December. So within that time, we've seen it spread substantially all over the world. We have learned as of this week how the virus interacts with respiratory cells. So the virus attaches to a receptor that is known as ACE2. You don't need to remember that, but know that the virus has spike proteins, which are called as much because they look like spikes, that stick off of its surface, and these plug into the receptor like a lock and key, and this allows the virus to merge its membrane with that of a host cell and inject genetic material, RNA, into the host cell, hijacking its machinery in order to replicate. So that is how this virus gets into respiratory cells and infects. And this is really important in terms of coming up with both vaccines and treatments. In terms of diagnostic testing within the U.S., we're now seeing academic institutions and private labs, private companies roll out their own diagnostic testing kits. Some places such as Minnesota and San Francisco are even setting up so-called drive-through testing. So it's not quite a drive-through in that you can just drive up whenever and get tested. But if you call ahead and have the appropriate symptoms, you can come and not have to enter the healthcare facility. So some places are now offering that, which is great. Generally speaking, diagnostic tests that are being developed are being approved by the FDA on kind of an emergency use authorization basis, which is EUA. It's a formal application. So as long as labs take basic tests or basic steps to validate the test they're coming up with and send off an application to the FDA, they are allowed to use those tests and the diagnostics that they gather from them. If you yourself think you might have the coronavirus or someone you know has the coronavirus, testing priority right now is being given to those who have severe respiratory distress and require a lot of medical support, as well as those who have been admitted to the hospital for other reasons, and those who have traveled from countries that have recently been heavily affected by the virus. So we're still, because diagnostic testing is not available to every single person who might want it, you're still going to see a lot of medical facilities triaging people based on risk assessment. So if you have no symptoms or really mild symptoms, it's better to self-quarantine. And maybe if your symptoms become worse, then seek medical attention and diagnostic testing. Always call ahead to see if it's even available where you're going. And of course, if you have pre-existing conditions that would make put you in a higher risk category for severe complications, you should seek medical attention sooner rather than later. I'm going to take a couple questions from you as we're coming into kind of the first third of our live stream here. I'm getting the question, when do you think this outbreak will peak? And do you think the weather changes in spring will help reduce the spread? So this has been an ongoing question about whether this coronavirus, like others that we've seen before, is affected by warmer temperatures. So other coronaviruses we've seen, including SARS, I believe, don't spread as easily in warm, really sticky weather. So as we, at least in part of the world, are moving into warmer months, there's been discussion around whether we think it might be possible that this will affect transmission. And the answer is still that we don't know. So as the weather warms, we'll see that actively, whether that makes a difference or not. And I don't have a good prediction as to whether that will make a huge difference as of yet. I have talked to experts that say that's not a bad assumption, but we can't make that assumption ahead of time. Right now, we need to prepare as if the outbreak will be ongoing for quite some time. And in terms of when I think it will peak, the struggle with this is that we've kind of, at least anecdotally, we've seen the peak at the epicenter of the outbreak, where it began in Wuhan, in Hubei province, more widely. So we've seen the cases there dip now. So unless they have a resurgence, which is possible, and we've seen with travelers coming into China more now, some resurgence in other areas, actually, it seems like there the outbreak has reached its peak. But elsewhere, as new, smaller outbreaks begin and like contribute to this global pandemic, you're going to see the peak kind of popcorn around the world. So it depends when it hits a region, what population lives there, what kind of crowding you have. So it's very variable depending on location. Should we be worrying about shipped materials from China or produced from other parts of the country where the virus is prominent? So we have gotten more data this week. There's a preprint, meaning that this paper hasn't been through peer review. So it hasn't been vetted by many other scientists as of yet. So this is very preliminary research, but there is data saying that the virus can last up to 24 hours on cardboard in certain conditions. That said, we don't believe that should change the safety of product shipped from other places, but we are following up with experts on whether they think that is truly the case, what they think about this preprint. And of course, if there are weaknesses in the paper or, you know, more questions to follow up on, we'll let you know. As of yet, packages should be considered safe for handling. When is an infected person contagious? When they have symptoms or no symptoms? So another preprint came out this week. This was based on a study of only 9 people. So again, take that as you will. And it's not through peer review yet. But it suggests that once people begin showing even early symptoms, that for the first 1 to 5 days of the illness is when they are at their most contagious. Again, this is a preliminary study. And this is mostly based on people with fairly mild infections. But those people, they found, they call it viral shedding, when you let off bits of the virus through your respiratory droplets. So they found that their degree of viral shedding was highest at days 1 through 5, peaking around day 4 generally, between 4 and 5. And then in people with mild infections, mind you, so still confined to the upper respiratory tract, you see the viral shedding dip after that point. And those people, as they recover from symptoms as well, by day 10, generally should not be contagious anymore. Meanwhile, people with more severe infections that advance to at least some degree of pneumonia, which is an infection in the lung tissue itself, which is a lower, more severe infection, you'll see viral shedding peak around day 10, 11 for those people. So you notice the slightly later peak. This is very different from the SARS virus, or the virus that causes SARS, which is a related coronavirus that we saw an outbreak in China in 2002, 2003, that also spread around the world. With SARS, people were at their most contagious later in the course of the disease when it had advanced to that pneumonia-like stage. So this is a difference where we're seeing people being contagious earlier, which might explain how this virus spread so rapidly. And again, that's a very preliminary study, so we'll follow up on that in the weeks to come. Do we expect the death rate to steadily decline as more knowledge on cases becomes available? Generally speaking, as the number of confirmed cases comes closer to reflecting the number of actual cases, you can expect the mortality rate associated with the virus, the infection fatality rate is what experts call it, to fall off. Because it's already so widespread and we have some regions where we've seen the pandemic play out through a peak and then a trough. So for instance, in China or South Korea, we feel that experts generally think that those mortality estimates confined to those areas might be more accurate and more reflective of the true mortality rate of the virus. So we should be seeing more regionalized data in that way. Within the US, because we don't know how many cases we have right now, that estimate is not going to be truly available for some time. But generally speaking, you would expect it to decline once we have more accurate numbers. What should we take from the fact that the highest percentage of fatalities so far are people 60 years old and above? So truly the highest, the most vulnerable bracket of people that we've seen so far are those above 80 years old. So people who contract this virus who are above the age of 80 are most likely to develop really severe complications and potentially die from the virus. And you see that, generally speaking, a very steady curve in the fatality rate from the youngest people who've caught it to the oldest. This is reflective of both how the immune system ages through time, we believe. So the immune system simply becomes less effective as you age. So that's part of it. But it's also that people of an older age are more likely to have pre-existing conditions that make them more vulnerable to respiratory failure and other forms of severe immune response. So we see that diabetes, cardiovascular diseases, and high blood pressure are some of the comorbidities, so previously existing conditions that really add to complications with this virus, which, if you notice, a lot of older people, generally speaking, as a demographic, have, if not one, multiple of those afflictions. And that just comes with aging, partly. So again, those any condition that puts strain on your immune response, your lung function, or your cardiovascular function, because the heart and the lungs work so closely together in that the lungs are what bring the oxygen into the body, obviously, and the blood is what brings it around the body. So if you put strain on the lungs, which is what the virus is doing, the heart has to work harder. And if your heart is compromised, that's a problem. So that's what you should take away from that. How vulnerable are children as compared to adults? Children with disabilities, are children with disabilities at greater risk than others? I assume in this context, you mean disabilities as in pre-existing conditions. So in children that are immunocompromised in some way, so again, their immune systems don't handle insult as well for whatever reason, or if they have lung or heart conditions, things like that would place children at higher risk should they catch the disease. If a child doesn't have an affliction like that, generally speaking, they're expected to have, they are able to catch the virus, but they have milder symptoms than we see in adults, to the point of sometimes not showing many symptoms at all. So we do see with age, again, more severe symptoms as you go. And that's been a trend that continues as we learn more about the virus. For those of you just joining us, to reiterate, we are working on location in Brooklyn today rather than in our Manhattan office, because we are, as a company, working from home, because as a news organization that mostly writes things for the internet and posts things on the internet, we are able to move our operation remote very easily. Generally speaking, the consensus among experts and especially among people in affected areas, heavily affected areas, is that if you are able to work from home right now, it's probably the best practice, because the more people working from home and limiting their commute time, limiting their time around other people, being in crowded environments, etc., will help to subdue the spread of the virus. And for those of you who don't have the privilege of working from home like we do, hopefully our working from home will somehow, you know, keep people from coming into your workplace as often and raising your risk of an infection. So it's a community-wide effort, is the point here. I'm getting questions about comparing symptoms of this virus to symptoms of other respiratory illnesses, for example, the seasonal flu. So let me just list the symptoms, the most common symptoms of this coronavirus. People tend to develop a dry cough and a fever. So if you have mild symptoms, you might get a mild fever. More severe symptoms would be a high fever. So people sometimes develop a runny nose, nausea, diarrhea, a lot of symptoms that are common to other forms of infection, which is why it's difficult to spot this at face value, especially if you're just feeling the fever and the nausea and body aches sometimes. You might just think this is a really bad cold or the flu. And that's, again, if you have a mild infection. If you have a severe infection and it progresses to your lung tissue, there's a chance you can develop pneumonia, which is a condition wherein the lung tissue becomes inflamed and fills with pockets of pus. And obviously that makes it very, very difficult to breathe and circulate oxygen throughout the body. I prefer to just list those symptoms as they are. I feel the comparisons to the flu might be not confusing, but I don't want to downplay the severity of this virus by comparing it to disease that we understand better and we have treatments and vaccines for. I'm hoping what you can take away from this is that this is a very distinct disease that should be taken seriously, of course. Some demographics are at lower risk of developing a severe infection. They might just catch it and not even know they have it, to be frank. But the point right now is that because we don't have treatments and we don't have preventative measures, if everyone can delay the time at which they become infected, we lessen the strain on our healthcare system to take care of the people who will need help. So that's the main takeaway. Someone's asking, why not check everyone for the virus just to make sure that they can't pass it on to others? To begin, here in the US specifically, but worldwide, there are simply not enough diagnostic tests to test every single person for the virus. Hopefully, it will at least become widespread enough that the people who we suspect have the virus can receive a test. So especially right now, people are being prioritized based on how sick they are, which is very true of disease in general. The people who are sickest should probably receive the most resources at that moment. Mostly the answer to that question is, if everyone right now got up and rushed to their nearest healthcare facility and there were tests available, even in that case, the sudden influx of people would put such a strain on the healthcare system that they couldn't, number one, treat people with the virus, but number two, treat people coming in for anything else. So say you are 9 months pregnant and you need to give birth tomorrow. You also need to get to a hospital if that's where you're choosing to give birth. And if the hospital's overrun with people trying to get diagnostic tests, you're not going to be able to do that. And that puts you and your child at risk, etc. That's just an extreme example, but there's many other medical catastrophes I'm sure you could conjure in your mind. So that's why not everyone should get a test for this virus. It's unnecessary and expensive in terms of the risks. Can you comment on the different types of tests and the issue of false positives, false negatives with different types, which is the most prominent for use in the US? So the tests that the CDC developed and many other tests that are in development work by sampling a swab from the person's nose and mouth. And within that sample, the test looks for bits of viral RNA. So that's the genetic material that the virus is not only made of, but injects into host cells, and that detects whether the virus is present or not. Mostly because this is a new, even the test for the flu, which we understand better, isn't 100% accurate all the time. It's very difficult to come up with a diagnostic exam that's 100% accurate every time. So that's where false positives and negatives come from, is simply because that's what the verification step is that the FDA requires every lab do as they make a new test, is that the test is as reliable as possible. So the verification process is making sure that the vast majority of the time when you use that test, it will bring you the accurate result. And that has to do with how we understand what the virus both looks like, how it functions, what its genetic material looks like, all that sort of thing. So the more we know about the virus, the better we can make the diagnostic tests. There are other types of tests in development. One type is trying to use CRISPR, the gene editing tool. And this works similarly to the other tests, but instead of searching for the viral genetic material one way, it will stick a fluorescent tag onto those bits of genetic material, causing them to glow in a way, change color. So it would work similarly to a pregnancy test, where you dip paper in some solution and it will change color if the virus is present. So that's another form of test. And then serological or blood tests are also in development, which look for antibodies that the body generates in response to a new pathogen in order to arm the immune system. So if those antibodies are present, that means the virus is circulating in the body, is the idea. Can domestic animals spread the coronavirus to humans? So this is asking, I assume, mostly about cats and dogs, but say ferrets, etc. So there was one anecdotal account that has been followed up on where a dog picked up the virus from its owner. The dog itself did not become sick, but tested weak positive for a slight infection. But there's no evidence that the dog can then pass on that pathogen to humans. And we saw the same in the SARS epidemic, actually, which is, again, a very closely related virus. So during the SARS epidemic, both household cats and dogs caught the virus. There were accounts that were verified, but those animals could not pass the virus on to humans. So they're thinking at this point that this virus works similarly. We are unsure what other types of mammals the virus infect and whether they become sick. There's some anecdotal evidence and some preliminary studies about different types of monkeys that might be able to catch the virus. And people are actively looking, actually, for animals that can catch the virus for use in vaccine development and things like that. For instance, during SARS, I don't believe mice could naturally be infected with SARS. So they had to figure out a way of how do you test treatments and vaccines without your experimental animal models to lead to humans. So you have to figure out which animals it's relevant for. Does this virus, if you catch it, give the person lifelong immunity? We do not know the answer to this question yet. With some viruses, you see a drop-off in immunity over time. So it's that the immune response against the virus, even though it's present in the body, becomes less effective over time. So there's been nobody that's recovered long enough yet that we really understand the full scope of immunity with this virus. But we're hoping that further research into how it infects, how it functions, will give us a look into whether the immune response is effective over a long period of time, say at least years, several years. We're actually nearing the end of this live stream, so I'm going to take two more questions. Someone is asking more specifically, if you've had respiratory problems with asthma, for instance, specifically, are you more vulnerable to this virus? Anyone can catch the virus. Let me make that clear first. So it's not that one demographic is more or less likely to catch the virus in the first place. But if you have asthma or have had persistent asthma throughout your life, you would likely be more prone to severe complications from the virus because it does target the lung tissue directly and the respiratory system in general. So if yours is compromised in some way, you may be prone to more severe complications. To follow up again on how long this virus survives on surfaces, initially there were estimates based on our understanding of other coronaviruses. So those have a pretty wide range of viability, depending on the surface as well. There is a recent preprint that we're covering. A preprint is a paper that hasn't gone through peer review, so it hasn't been vetted by the scientific community yet or published in a paper formally, as a paper formally, which suggests that on some surfaces, the virus can survive. I have the exact numbers here that I can give you. For instance, on copper, they're estimating that it's detectable, so the virus, if sampled from that environment, the viral DNA, RNA, can be detected in general. On copper, the time is about 4 hours. On plastic and stainless steel, it's detectable for multiple days, 2 to 3, and then on cardboard as long as 24 hours. But again, this is just a preliminary study, and just because the virus is detectable and in an experimental setting, we don't yet know how that translates to it being transmissible to people. So a good test for how infectious something is to take a sample of that virus, isolate it, and try to grow virus in the lab from that sample that you've collected from the environment. This study did not take that measure. So right now they're just looking at, yes, we can see the virus on these surfaces, but it's unclear if the viral load at this point is high enough to actually infect people. And again, if you wipe down any of those surfaces with household disinfectants, ones that are alcohol-based or bleach-based, those should break down the membrane of the coronavirus and kill it regardless. So if you're concerned about how long the virus is lasting on, say, your household countertops, doorknobs, if you wipe them down with standard products, the virus should be inactivated in that way. And with that, I'm actually going to wrap up this week's live stream. Thank you again for tuning in and offering lots of questions. We do have a public forum where you can post more questions. That is forums.livescience, livescience with a V.com. And if you want to read up on all the answers to most of these questions are on our website, livescience.com. So if you want to read up on anything I've said today or come up with more questions to send us, please check out the website. And if anything doesn't make sense to you, come back here. You can comment on this video, but we are here to serve you and try to answer as many questions as we can. Thank you again for tuning in.
Thanks for joining us for this special coronavirus report from Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. You can find all the Live Science coverage of the coronavirus and COVID-19 on our website at livescience.com/topics/coronavirus.
We'll be refreshing our FAQ and coronavirus updates daily as information becomes available. The link is in the show notes.
If you have questions about coronavirus or COVID-19, you can post them on our Live Science forums and on Facebook.
Thanks for joining us, and stay healthy.
Life's Little Mysteries is produced in conjunction with Audio Boom as part of their Audio Boom Originals Network.